on revenue for Tuesday, February 19th, 2008 will come to order. We're going to take things out of the order that they're published in on the agenda today and open the work session on Senate Bill 1101. Now, as I came in today, people reminded me that we had agreed that we would extend the public hearing on this bill into today, and it did not get posted that way. So I want to know if there are people here who would like to be heard today. I see one. Two. Would you gentlemen come forward, please? We're going to hear him. And gentlemen, you're talking on the bill today and on the amendments that we have before us. Is that correct? Yes, thank you.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Tim Martinez here on behalf of the Oregon Bankers Association. I'm joined on my right by Ken Sherman, longtime counsel, although young man, of the Oregon Bankers Association. We thank you for hearing this bill so quickly. I would make my testimony would be brief. I'd give you a number, 29. That's the number of votes it had in the Senate, zero opposed. You heard some testimony yesterday. It is not our intent in this legislation to undo or to change the policy of last session's legislation. As you know, Mr. Chairman, we've been talking to you for several months now about the need to make some minor tweaks to make this thing work. And that's all we're attempting to do here. If folks want to expand the bill in the next legislative session, that's certainly this body's prerogative. But what we're trying to do is make it work. After the bill passed, and I think those of you on the committee last time would agree that you were looking at this issue from probably the 50,000 foot level, when we got down to the ground and worked with the Department of Revenue in rulemaking, we discovered that there were some things that were ambiguous, some things that simply needed to be fixed.
And that we've heard that refrain before.
Yes, you have. Yes, you have. And you'll probably hear it again. It's not unique. It's page 8 in our playbook. At any rate, so we did make those changes. We worked very closely with the department. I want to say very publicly that we appreciate the department and their efforts to make this get this bill where it is today. We believe that it will improve the bill, and again, our goal is not to to undo anything that the last session's body passed. So with that, I'll turn it to my expert, Ken Sherman, Jr., and I would tell you, although he didn't come up with this, that if you do have additional questions, Cleve Abbey, from the Title Association is here as well.
Thank you. And did you have any comments about the amendments, the dash 7s, 8s, and 9s?
Mr. Chairman, we support all three.
You do. Thank you. Yes, sir.
Mr. Chairman, I'm Ken Sherman, and I'm counsel to the Oregon Bankers Association. I was privileged to serve on the advisory committee that was put together by the Department of Revenue following the 2007 passage of House Bill 2592. Served on that advisory committee with a broad variety of people, representatives of the title industry, the financial industry, the group that brought the original legislation to the 2007 legislature, and of course our host, the Department of Revenue. So there were many people from many perspectives at that table. We do strongly support the enactment of this. The rulemaking process brought to light a number of technical problems with the bill. The bill now before you will preserve the basic thrust and intention of 2592. It does clarify the definitions and results in a much tighter and easier to administer and less expensive to administer bill. Your staff did an excellent job yesterday of summarizing the detail, and I'm not going to go through any of that today. Just to say that we have carefully worked this and worked on the amendments 7, 8, and 9. We do support those, and at this time I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, Representative Vance.
Mr. Chairman, line at the second page, line 30, 38, 39, 40, does that include 1031 exchanges?
38, 39. So I believe that's the 1031 language. Cleve Abbey is with us if he wants to come up and clarify that to be sure, but I think that's what that language is designed to deal with. It talks about exchange in there, so yes, that would be correct.
Thanks.
Representative, is that the personal residence issue or something else?
No. Mr. Chairman, a 1031 exchange is an exchange of business property, investment real property, for another piece of like-kind property.
Right. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But, Mr. Chair, we did hear yesterday that Section 121 refers to the personal residence, I think, as well, if I'm remembering right. My notes are right.
That's from my notes, too.
All right. Well, I intended to ask Legislative Council some other questions. Perhaps we can ask about that one as well. Thank you.
All right.
Other questions? We appreciate it very much. And would like to hear from Legislative Council. I had a question about one of the amendments, and perhaps you can address that question as well.
Good morning. Chair Barnhart, members of the committee.
Yes, please.
Kate Toswell from Legislative Council.
Can you respond to Representative Bent's question?
Yes, Representative Bent. Chair Barnhart, the language on page 2, lines 38 through 40 does address the personal residence exception, section 121, the exception for gain. For a personal residence.
Now, go ahead, Representative Bench, you're probably going to ask the question I was thinking.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, the question is, 1031, of course, is not personal residence, it's capital assets. Is it the next line that you're relying upon, F? Is that the, or what is, I just want to make sure it's there.
Yes, I believe that paragraph F addresses that, even though it doesn't specifically refer to the IRC citation.
Thank you.
Just to follow up on that, under Oregon law, an exchange which qualifies under federal law as a non-taxable event also qualifies under Oregon state law, does it
yes.
not?
Yes.
So F would actually cover that issue, wouldn't it?
Yes, it would. And although, Chair Barnhart, it is not, it doesn't say.
It's not explicitly stated, but if no taxes are due, then you simply declare that.
Right, there is no taxable event.
Right. Thank you. I had another question, and maybe other members do as well, on the amendments. On the Dash 8 amendments, there's a very short piece on lines 3 to 6, which simply clarify which simply clarifies the role of the attorney. What I don't understand is, and maybe still don't, even though we discussed this briefly before the meeting, why we need to add the language on line 13, which modifies ORS 696.581 in that one little way. If you'll notice, colleagues, that the rest of the bill is simply an inclusion of that ORS section, and the only change is line 13. Could you explain why that language is added?
Yes, Chair Barnhart, that language deals with Chapter 696 and licensed escrow agents, and without that proviso, the escrow agent will be required to act on instructions in writing from the principals. As you see in line 15, this amendment envisions a situation where an attorney is acting in the transaction along with a licensed escrow agent, and as you see in lines 3 through 6 of the A8s, the attorney is essentially handling the escrow. And I believe the intention behind the A8s is to remove a situation where an attorney, although they're representing one of the parties, as seen in the A and Gross bill, there could be a situation where they're representing a party but not directly in connection with the closing of the escrow. So the addition in line 13 of the A8s would remove the stricture on the escrow agent if, in fact, an attorney was acting in their stead. But it still envisions both types of agents being involved in the same conveyance.
Thank you. Other questions of counsel? Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I would like to move the Dash A7 amendment to Senate Bill 1101, which refers to clarifying the agent language.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves the A7. Is there any discussion? Is there objections to adding the A7s? I don't see any, so your motion is passed. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A8 amendments to Senate Bill 1101. This is the one we just discussed. It clarifies some language around attorneys and escrow agents and the interaction on the ground.
Right. Thank you. The A7s put attorneys in, and the A8s take them out in a different situation. Right. Thank you. Further discussion on the A8-8s? I don't see any. Is there any objection to the dash-8s? I don't see any, so the dash-8s are carried. Thank you. Representative Berger.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A9 amendments to Senate Bill 1101. This just simply makes clear that submission in the language means submission to the department.
Right. That was an ambiguity that... thank you. Representative Berger moves the dash A9 amendments. That was the ambiguity that I thought I saw yesterday in the instructions that at the very end of the bill where it allows the department to write rules. And procedures for submission, but it didn't say submission to whom. So anyway, we've got that now. Any further discussion on the A9s? Is there any objection to the A9s? I don't see any objection, so the A9s are adopted. I'd like to hear briefly before we finish this from the department. Representative Reed has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Governor, we talked before about my being struck by the word unlikely on line 41 of page 2, and I was just hoping you could help us understand your thinking behind that and some of the thoughts about how the rules might be written to accommodate that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan with the Department of Revenue. Representative Reed, to your question as to what those might look like, we expect to develop a form and instructions that escrow agents will use, and that would constitute a written affirmation. A section on that form might be, for example, if you have a California resident with Oregon real property, and the California resident sells the property. Under Oregon law, the California resident is able to take a credit against Oregon taxes on the Oregon non-resident return. So to the extent the California tax is higher than Oregon's tax, it would eliminate any tax liability that California resident would have. In that case, it might make sense to have them provide us that information in the written affirmation to say they won't owe tax on that transaction because of the credit, so it wouldn't make sense to have the withholding and then file a return just to claim that refund. A situation where we think that probably a taxpayer might indicate they're unlikely to owe tax is if they expect to generate losses later in the year from stock market transactions, for example, and those losses would then wipe out the gain on the transaction. That would be a case where there should still be withholding because they might not have those losses. So in that case, even though the transferor might want to indicate that they're unlikely to owe tax, there should still be withholding in that case. So those are a couple of examples that I could think of.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Yes, please.
Thank you. So it's your intent, to be accurate to say that it's your intent to have transferors go through some calculation to demonstrate the likelihood beforehand.
Mr. Chair, Representative Reed, the written affirmation and the form should have some calculations because that's what they need to do in order to calculate any withholding that would be required. So, yes, they should be putting down the consideration. They can calculate the estimated expenses to come up with the taxable gain if that's going to give them a lower number. So, yes, there would be calculations on that form.
Thank you.
Thank you. Other questions for the department? Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Appreciate it. Representative Berger?
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move Senate Bill 1101A engrossed as amended by this committee to the floor with a D-pass recommendation.
Thank you. Representative Berger moves Senate Bill 1101 as amended to the floor with a D-pass recommendation. Discussion? I don't see any.
Well,
oh, yes, please.
I would just like to put on the record that a lot of people have worked very hard in the interim to bring us this. It has been a work of folks who wanted to make this work, and I appreciate their efforts, including the department and the folks on the ground. And it was an open process to try and make our will manifest, and it was good effort.
Thank you, and I appreciate your making that remark. It, in the rush to get this special short session finished, I sometimes forget to acknowledge the great work of a large number of people who help us with bills. And this committee continues to depend upon members of the public and professionals to help us write legislation that will actually work in the real world. And we very much appreciate the involvement of all those who were here to help us make this work. I think it's very clear to say that in this bill, as is true with some of the others we've handled this session, this is not a finished product, but it's a work in progress. I wouldn't be at all surprised to find the department or someone else coming back next year saying, well, we need these additional changes in order to make the thing work. That's the nature of legislation. It will always be the nature of legislation. And we cannot do our work without the help of members of the public. And I really appreciate you raising that issue, Representative Berger. Thank you. Is there further discussion? Yeah, Representative Vance.
Mr. Chairman, I think I mentioned yesterday that I had a conflict, but I honestly don't remember if it's this bill or another, and I just want to make sure the record reflects our firm does represent.
Okay. Thank you. Your conflict is noted for the record. Others? Okay, with that, we'll vote. Please call the roll.
Representative Bennett.
Aye.
Representative Brother.
Aye.
Representative Boone.
Aye.
Representative Gelson.
Excused.
Representative Olson.
Excused.
Representative Reed.
Aye.
Representative Rosenbaum.
Aye.
Representative Witt.
Aye.
Chair Barnhart.
Aye. The bill, having received the required majority, is adopted and will go to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Reed, you carried 2592, did you not?
I did.
Would you carry this one as well?
So long as I could depend on my expert colleagues for help, I'd be pleased to, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative Reed will carry. And with that, we will close the work session on Senate Bill 1101. And we will open our information meeting on the other fund's revenue forecast.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Last time we talked was Friday. Since we had a three-day weekend, it was nice and relaxing. And last time we were talking about the other funds forecast. The other funds forecast, just to refresh your memory, is the set of funds classified in the state revenue system as other funds. Those other funds are most of the times required to do certain and fund certain activities within the state. However, if those funds are not available sometimes, the general fund will be the one that is required to cover up for these activities. Now, the other funds are required by law to be forecast, or the forecast to be presented twice a year, in June and in December. And you have in front of you this statement, and this is from the Director of Department of Administrative Services, DAS. This was presented at the end of November for the December requirement of the other funds forecast. The other funds forecast is as you would see in these amounts that we are looking at here, is about $5 billion a biennium. That's almost as half as the general fund. However, that does not include all other funds within the state system. These are a selected number of other funds. There's 20 more of them. Mr. Chair, the other funds forecast is coordinated by what we call the forecasting of the Central Forecasting Organ within the state system, that's the Office of Economic Analysis, would like to have Dave Beck. He is the Deputy State Economist. He comes here to present this to you and also present the other agencies bringing this forecast to you and to your attention. So, with your permission, Mr. Chair, we ask Dave to make his presentation.
Thank you. Mr. Beck.
Morning. Chair Barnhart and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Dave Beck, Office of Economic Analysis at the Department of Administrative Services. I trust you have in front of you the report entitled Selected Other Funds Revenue December 1, 2007 Forecast. We're here today to talk about this forecast. In fact, I'm accompanied by the representatives from various agencies who put forward to us the respective revenue forecast in our report. We appreciate the opportunity to present to you this forecast. In a moment, representatives from various agencies will discuss their respective forecasts. I want to take this opportunity to thank all those agencies who really worked hard to put together this presentation on such short notice. The first presentation is by ODOT.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm Lorna Youngs, Deputy Director for Central Services with the Department of Transportation. And we're very pleased to be able to share with you our revenue forecast. With me today is Dave Cavanaugh, who is the State Transportation Economist, and he will be presenting to you an overview of the most current forecast for our other fund state transportation revenues.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman and Revenue Committee panel members. A brief overview. Mr. Malik already gave a kind of the background in this preamble about the nature of these other funds revenues. Again, these are funds that the agency collects within the state of Oregon from fuel taxes and vehicle registration fees and driver's license fees and title fees. I'll get into the makeup of those components a little bit more after I get done with the overview comments. The total amount of revenues from that ODOT collects within the state amount to about $1.9 to $2 billion per biennium. In contrast to the general fund, it's comparatively small. It's less than one-seventh of the general fund revenues, to give you an idea or a sense of proportion. When we supply the other fund's revenue forecast to DAS for them to go ahead and assemble it on a statewide basis, we just report gross revenues. We don't go ahead and try to give a picture of what the resources are available to the agency to support its programs, such as the maintenance program, preservation program, and the modernization program. So I thought I'd go ahead and highlight a little bit of what we wind up with in terms of net revenues after the agency does transfers. For example, we also have collection costs, program costs, administrative costs that have to come out of the gross revenues. There are interagency transfers where we collect fuel taxes, for example, for non-highway uses of gasoline, where those get transferred to other agencies, such as the Department of Aviation and the Marine Board. There are also funds that stay within ODOT that are dedicated to specific programs, for example, the Senior and Elderly Transportation Program that's run by the Transit Division. Once we take these three components out of the gross number of the $1.9 to $2 billion, there's only about $1.4 to $1.5 billion left per biennium. And finally, another component that enters into the net revenue calculation, you're all aware that we transfer money from the state highway fund into our local governments. All the counties and the municipalities share in the gross revenues. There are a number of apportionment formulas for the counties and the cities, but on as a composite, the local governments get a little bit more than 40% of the net revenues of the highway fund, and the residual, a little bit less than 60%, stays with the state highway fund. Once we take the apportionments into consideration, it means that the discretionary resources available to the agency amount to about $800 to $900 million per biennium. So you can see it's greatly reduced in terms of our discretionary purchases to support our programs. Finally, this excludes federal funds. The reason I bring this up is because I want to talk a little bit about federal funds towards the conclusion of my brief presentation. But these are, again, just revenues that are collected within the state of Oregon from endogenous taxes and fees. Continuing briefly with the overview, how do we forecast transportation revenues? Besides very carefully and diligently, we use a statistical time series models. These are models, structurally, they're very similar to the types of models that are used in the state economic forecasting model. What do we assume for the forecast? We link very closely with the state economic forecast. A lot of the variables that we use to explain the different taxes and fees to go ahead and forecast are the same variables that are forecast in the Office of Economic Analysis model. However, there are some variables that we use that aren't forecast within the state. For example, the consumer sentiment index that we think influences spending on travel demand, if you will, on gasoline. There are some variables that aren't forecast within the state, but what we use is the same macroeconomic forecast that is used to drive the state model, and that's the ones provided by the contractor at the Global Insights. What I hope to focus on here real briefly is just to compare two of our most recent forecasts, the one that we did in June of 2007. This was the forecast that was the most recent one available when DAS assembled the December 1st, 2007 other funds forecast. Since then, we've done an updated forecast, which we call the December 2007 forecast. That's a forecast that would match up with the forecast from the Office of Economic Analysis as of December. And, of course, because of the supplementary session, the timetable has been accelerated on distributing the forecasts. There's been a new one, the March 2008 forecast, that has recently been done. So, if you will, there's a little bit of a disconnect between our most recent and the most recent one that came out of the Office of Economic Analysis. What comprises our other funds forecasts? Two ways of kind of classifying our revenues. There's revenues by source. The major component of that, we have the $1.9 billion per biennium for the current biennium forecast. Motor fuels taxes is by far the largest one. That's light vehicles paying gasoline tax and diesel fuel tax. Weight mile taxes are those paid by heavy trucks in excess of 26,000 pounds. That's the next largest component. The remaining three components are related to the vehicle license fees, which are registration fees across all the light passenger vehicles, all the medium heavy vehicles, trailers, if you will, charitable vehicles, and also heavy trucks in the state. Another component, about $84 million per biennium, are driver's license fees. This is the whole continuum of driver's licenses, individual as well as commercial, but it also embodies a lot of the tests that are done for commercial drivers, for example, hazard tests and test income that originates with those. The final component by source are the other transportation license and revenue fees. These are largely revenues that receives from titles and title transfers and vehicles that are new to Oregon that require titling. Another way of classifying our revenues is to look at kind of how they originate by type. And what we've done on the right-hand side of the chart is we've aggregated revenues into user taxes. Those are revenues that we receive that vary with usage on the system. The other component are the vehicle and driver and other fees. Those are fee incomes that don't vary with usage. If you will, they're like buying the membership to the gym, but once you get into the gym, it doesn't vary with how active you are in the gym or how much you use the facilities. It's just a membership, so to speak, or access to that. It doesn't vary with usage. What is the outlook, our current outlook for forecasting revenues? What Figure 2 does is it does a pairwise comparison of our forecast from last June with the most recent forecast, December 07. And it also it builds up the total gross revenues by a major source that I talked a little bit about on the prior slide. A number of salient features kind of suggest themselves here. One, there hasn't been too much change from our December forecast over the forecast from this last summer. The revenues grow very slowly over time at a rate of about 1.9% per year on average under current law and current fees, without assuming there's any changes in taxes or fees. And unfortunately, that's at a rate slower than the general rate of inflation that our construction programs confront, so we have diminishing purchasing power there. I'm sure you've heard some about that. Another component of this is that the December 2007 forecast is slightly higher than the June forecast. This is largely an outgrowth of embodying the effects of HB 2210, which was the biofuels bill. There's a lot of prevailing evidence in science that says that ethanol is probably going to create a little bit poorer energy efficiency, or MPG, if you will, in cars. I don't know. We might want to take the opportunity and do a non-scientific poll to see if people have been noticing a drop in their gas mileage. But the current model, once the Department of Agriculture implemented the Oregon administrative rules for 2210, we had something to kind of work with, and we put in kind of a loss of efficiency, if you will, so that will boost up our gallons of gasoline that are sold. Doesn't have an effect on diesel or used fuel sales, and that accounts for a little bit stronger revenues in terms of the level going forward. What are the trends implicit in that in figures 2, so kind of temporal pattern there? What I've done in figure 3 here is to try to show the disparate growth rates in the different revenues by source. On the left-hand side, what we have there is the 3.9% for motor fuels revenue. That's the average increase on a biennium basis out through the 2011-2013 biennium. Weight miles, as you can see, is the largest or fastest growing one at about 5.1%. That's largely due to our robust manufacturing sector, and the value added in that sector is growing very rapidly because of productivity gains. The other three components are a little bit smaller, 2.3% for vehicle license fees, 1.2% for license fees, and the 1.6% you see for the others. That largely reflects demographic trends and in-migration to the state, the number of vehicles, driver's licenses, if you will. So they're at about half, not half, but they're a little bit lower rate than the ones that are related to usage activities. In sum, we don't see a real big change in the forecast from last summer to December's forecast. Transportation revenues, other fund revenues are seemingly more stable than the general fund revenues. We have a pretty modest growth going forward, as I mentioned, about the 1.9% annual average. And the revenue shares by source under current law and legislation are roughly constant over the period, so there aren't any broad changes under current law. Now, no forecast would be complete without throwing out some caveats and qualifications to give the forecaster a little bit of wiggle room, so that would be concerns governing our outlook. The first one is the national economic landscape is starting to get a little bit unclear. It's not really sure whether we're headed for a recession or whether maybe it's a minor blip in the economy. A couple of Fridays ago, you heard the forecast from the state economist and giving the outlook, and things are getting a little bit tenuous. And right now, I'm kind of thinking that we'll have a lot better idea come the June time frame after we get a few more quarters, if you will, of data as to where we are going forward. There's a lot of global economic volatility out there. A lot of it stems from the credit market malaise that we're in and subprime problems. The list is pretty long to try to go into, but there is that volatility that's buffeting the U.S. economy, and ergo, it obviously affects the Oregon economy. Federal funds potential shortfalls, it looks right now as if in the very near term there may be $4 to $5 billion nationwide that will less that will be distributed by from the Federal Highway Trust Fund. If that comes to be, and Congress may not let it happen, but if it does, it's kind of a worst case, then in the federal fiscal year starting in October of 2008, ODOT might be looking at about $200 million less in federal revenues. And carrying that into the more of a short-term horizon, a $6 billion shortfall in the following fiscal year might hit ODOT's other revenues to the tune of about $100 million. And I only bring this to your attention because it does have an effect on how we configure our construction programs for the STIP in terms of getting the biggest bang for our buck and interacting the two. So if there's a big uncertainty about how reliable that $200 million is from the federal government, from the Highway Trust Fund, then it affects how we look at project configuration in the STIP. There's the old nemesis, oil prices. The big concern there is that it will continue to sap purchasing power from consumers and therefore slow the economy considerably. And then finally, construction cost volatility. And that concludes my comments.
Thank you.
We'd be happy to answer any questions you may have.
I think that's a great idea. Questions? I have one, and I suspect other members aren't asking us because they already know the answer. Can you give us a short summary of the experience the department is having in terms of the inflation in construction costs? I know that it's well above the CPI. But I don't know exactly how much.
Mr. Chair, the 2004 to 2006 period, it was on the order of about 3 to 4 times more than what the consumer inflation rate was. 2007, it has come down a little bit. And going forward, it looks like it may only be slightly above the average annual rate of consumer inflation. But as you all know, we've been hearing a lot of stories about food commodity inflation in conjunction with energy inflation. So even consumer inflation could probably run a little bit higher than the comfort zone of 1 to 2%. But it's several orders of magnitude. It has been buffeting the construction budgets.
Thank you. And there, we don't have anything built into our revenue stream in the area that we've been discussing this morning to deal with cost increases, do we? I mean, the only thing in there is a small change based on growth of licenses or small growth in utilization.
Mr. Chair, that's right. Those are based on kind of the real variables, if you will, travel demand, miles traveled, and number of vehicles that are being registered and the number of drivers that are getting licenses or renewals. We don't factor in any kind of escalation because that would be assuming something in particular about changes in fees and taxes due to legislation.
Right. Thank you.
Yes,
I'd like to follow on that line of questioning. So you forecast that the revenue growth going forward is pretty stable, 1.92%. We're talking about inflation, even pulling out the construction inflation, that still hasn't met what I think I know as the CPI, and it certainly doesn't come close. Not only in the short term, but even the long term for construction inflation. So my question is, for how many years has the buying power of ODOT been decreasing?
Representative Brown, The gas tax, the state gas tax, was last increased, perhaps you know, in 1993. So that's been about a 15 or a 16-year span. That's the major component of the motor fuel taxes. There have been some other components, the OTIA 1 and 2 legislation and the OTIA 3 legislation, which increased some fees for licenses and registration. It also increased the weight mile tax so that the revenue recovery from the different vehicle classes would stay roughly aligned with cost causality. Overall, I can't really answer that question because it's so mixed.
Can I ask that's fair? Because you know, one of the things trying to distill this down to talk to my constituents about this is, does the state have enough money or not? And from what I see is we knew this before this presentation, but we haven't been even breaking even for decades, let alone moving ahead anywhere.
That's correct. Overall, the budget, once we put it on an inflation-adjusted basis, representative right. run, or a constant dollar basis is the way economists usually like to phrase it, but it's not very intuitive. Generally, the purchasing power of the net revenues have been declining. But as an offset to that, with innovation and productivity gains, you can kind of mitigate those cost rises, if you will, but they may not completely override it. But,
do those improvements and efficiencies and economies of scale, though, have they made up for the, forget about the inflation for a moment, but have they caught up with the increased jurisprudence, for lack of a better word, that goes into building highways and roads? I mean, 30 years ago, we didn't have to go through nearly as much permitting and environmental quality, background checks, or whatever you want to call it, that we do today. I mean, those are all important, but those all have a cost of time and resource use as well. And so my question is, has the economies of scale caught up with the increased demands from government, frankly?
Mr. Chair, Representative Lumen, if I may, no, we have not. You are absolutely correct that the buying power of the Department of Transportation has been declining.
Thank you very much. And, of course, all of us have been through the reviews in which we've seen the estimates of the shortfalls in the neighborhood of $800 million just on maintenance, for example, biennium. So I think that's sort of the background for our questions in this area. So, and, of course, this committee really needs to be aware of that and in the long haul looking at what we can do to mitigate that problem. Thank you.
Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you very much. Mr. Beck?
Next up is the Employment Department.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Representative Berger.
While they're coming up, I would like to call your attention to page 4 of this Oregon Department of Transportation flyer and point out to Mr. Beck and Mr. Warner that if they brought us charts that look like this for income, our jobs would be a lot easier. Thank you very much.
We'll recommend that to them. Thank you, Representative Berger.
Hi, Mr. Chairman of the committee. My name is Tom Byerly, the administrator for the Unemployment Insurance Program for the Employment Department. With me today is Ahmad Rasmazadeh. He's our economist for the Unemployment Insurance Program. Mr. Chair, if I might, based on Representative Berger's comment, I think I should run for my life. I don't have any fancy charts. Just want to give a quick overview of the Unemployment Insurance Program that was created by the Social Security Act of 1935. It's been around for 73 years or so. Provide temporary assistance to workers that are unemployed through no fault of their own and meet legal eligibility requirements. This program is funded by employer contributions to the State Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, as you may be aware, and that's probably what your interest is today. The program maintains purchasing power for those that are out of work in local economies. And I want to stress that unemployment insurance is not based on need, but it's on eligibility, much like any insurance program. And the individual must meet some terms to qualify. They must have worked and earned a sufficient amount as an employee. They must be unemployed through no fault of their own, and they must be able to work, available for work, and actively seeking new work. The program goals we have are wage replacement through providing benefits to unemployed workers. We provide economic stability to local economies by partially offsetting loss of wages. And I want to stress, in the last recession, 2002 and 2003, we paid out $1.3 billion in unemployment insurance benefits through our system in both those years. We are looking around, we are about the fourth largest industry back then, keeping our economy strong. This also allows employers to shut down during slower times so they can expect their workers to return because they have a little bit of money to hold them over until they're ready to come back to work. It also helps them facilitate their reemployment by having earnings to support their families. Moving on to the question ahead about program financing, our program is financed by two employer taxes, two payroll taxes. One goes to the Internal Revenue Service, and it's used to administer our program. It pays our salaries, keeps our buildings open, and that is the Federal Unemployment Tax Act, or you might hear us kick around the acronym FUTA. So the federal go back and pay for our administration. There's a separate tax that is collected by the Employment Department in my tax branch that finances the benefits to pay to eligible individuals, and that's, again, deposited into the state trust fund. We use 8 tax schedules to determine and adjust employer rates based on the solvency of the unemployment insurance trust fund. The specific rate is within the schedule is assigned based on their specific experience. Like any insurance program, if you have more layoffs or more claims, your rates would go up based on your experience. Employers whose workers have received more benefits, then they would have that higher rate. The UI tax schedules are designed to ensure that a sufficient reserve is on hand to cover 18 months of our worst recession. And right now, that would be the last recession we had of 2001. So we have to have 18 months worth of benefits to cover 150% of the cost of a high-cost period in the last 10 years, which we're using 2001, or 150% of the cost to maintain a 5.6% insured unemployment rate presently in effect. When we have the desired level on hand in the trust fund, we are at Schedule 4 of 8, right in the middle. And if we have less than desired rate, we go up to as high as Schedule 8. If we have more than the schedules, or more than we need in our trust fund, we go down. Right now, we're in Schedule 2. We're fairly healthy.
For the purpose of an example, we'll look at two ends of the spectrum, Schedule 1 and 8.
Schedule 1, we're trying to reduce the size of the UI trust fund, so we're actually paying out more than we're collecting, with an average of 1.47% on the average payroll for an employer. In Schedule A, we're trying to build the size of the trust fund, so we're collecting an average of 3.08% of taxable payroll. Schedule 4 is the equilibrium, like I mentioned before. It's right in the middle, and it's intended to keep us even. And right now, we have sufficient funds to pay for such a recession, and we have a real solid trust fund. In fact, the U.S. Department of Labor says we are a model state as far as how we administer our trust fund. With that, I'd like to turn it over to Ahmad real quickly to go over how we forecast the tax rate calculations.
As Tom mentioned, the model we use is a complete
solid. Excuse me, would you state your name for the record, please?
My name is Ahmad Rustamizadeh. I'm a economist for Employment Department.
Thank you. Please go ahead.
The model we use is a mix of econometrics and actuarial model because it's an insurance program, and what they're trying to target, to establish a target that when we reach that target, the tax cuts will fluctuate between 8 to 1 and balance to that target. Last, a simple example, set the thermostat in your house 79 degrees, it all the time works to reach that target. That's how the system works. And we try all the time to have 18 months of resources to pay unemployment insurance when we go to recession. And it is planned that when we go to recession and economy slow down, we stay in lower tax casual, don't don't push the employer and they said pay more taxes. Right now, we calculated last year in September we're going to be in tax schedule 2 in 2008. We're going to stay in 2002. Doesn't matter if we are in recession or not. And the trust fund is very healthy. We have about $2.1 billion in the trust fund. We should be able easily cover a recession if we recession take place by the end of the year. We don't know yet. And the other aspect of the trust fund is that is we all the time monitor it, that the target we establish, you know, is good or bad or is high. And in 2005, Employment Department introduced a bill 2127. The target was established. We have two criteria for the target. One, we look at the last 10 years and see what the highest cost in that time, the 10 years was, times 150% of that. And the other one, we look at insured unemployment rate. This is another criteria. It's like total unemployment, but is it the rate come from Employment Department? And it was established at 7%. That means recession of 82-75. We thought, oh, that's really high, you know. We have to bring it low. And House Bill 2127 that unanimously passed in the legislative session of 2005, bring it lower from 7% to 5.6. If we didn't have that bill, right now we were in tax schedule 4 instead of 2. So we promised them that they're going to save about $200-300 million, and they save it. And that's why they're still saving it. And we thought that 7% is too high. We continuously monitor it, that be solvent, at the same time be fair to employers and employees, that when we go to recession, that we pay unemployment insurance, we cover. But one of the aspects of this system is, if you look at the table in the back, is a graph, you know, say what's the trust fund balance. There are two in the back, tell you how, one of them is taxes collected, the other one is benefit pay, and the other line is trust fund balance. Trust fund balance continues.
Mr. Chair, this is the handout that we gave you Friday, and we didn't bring extra copies again.
We don't
have. Do you want a copy?
Give one.
Thank you very much. Please go ahead.
And if you look at that graph, trust fund going up, somebody might ask, why is the case? It's index. Everything that we do, benefits and taxes are indexed to inflation. And the covered employment, that the population in Oregon is continuously increasing. Oregon is a growing economy. So it's indexed to how much population is increasing and what percentage of them is covered by unemployment insurance. So these two indexes, inflation and covered employment, continuously index the trust fund and the taxes we collect and the benefits we pay, of course, indexed to the inflation. It depends on the wages that people make. So as a result, this system is not going to be obsolete after a few years because it's indexed. It's like any other insurance. It continuously adjusts itself to the solvency level that establishing the law.
Change your forecast. Huh? Go ahead, talk about the forecast.
Yes, about the forecast, back to the forecast, we use econometric and actuarial model, and when we do forecast, is the difference between this forecast and the other is that the 8-side tax schedule we have. We finally, you know, the last forecast I did, the supply for revenue, the revenue is just taxes collected. But in the system is one factor. We look at benefit, we look at taxes, the two cannot be separated because the target, the ultimate target is what's the trust fund balance going to be. So we cannot separate them. But in this forecast, they ask us for other revenue, and we supply the taxes collected to the
table one of the handout.
And if you look at the last page that I attached to that, that gives the forecast. Look, for instance, look at 07-09, as we mentioned, you know, in the previous forecast was based on that we're going to be in tax schedule 3 in 2008. But actually, we end up to go to tax schedule 1, and what happened, the revenue were about $80 million lower than we forecasted because we moved to lower tax schedule. So it's this continuous type of model, you know, it depends what tax schedule we are in. So it adjusts itself, and when we calculate tax schedule in September, is this actual data that have it with the previous years. So the actual, all the time, the actual data play to establish what tax schedule we are. And if trust fund too high, come down the schedule. So you adjust itself, you know. Do you have any questions?
Thank you very much. Questions for this panel?
Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Rosenbaum.
I do have a question, if you'll indulge me, because this question really goes beyond the scope of just the other fund's revenue forecast. But I came across this statement in the overview, which covers all the agencies, that says the decrease for the 07-09 biennium is based on the revised September economic forecast and the assumption that being in a lower tax schedule as a result of a better economy will generate less tax revenue. And so that was based on the September forecast. Obviously, we got an updated forecast, which is really the March forecast, where things are not looking quite so rosy. So I'm wondering if you have made any changes in your assumptions based on this more recent forecast.
Yes. In the update I gave you, the table 1 show you based on the latest economics forecast we did. I forecasted what tax schedule we're going to be and how much taxes and benefits we're going to pay. But we have to keep in mind that state economy still is not forecasting recession. We use their baseline, and based on that, we don't have any recession in this model, even this forecast. If we go to a recession, as I say, by the end of the year, we might bounce back, but we are solvent, the trust fund solvent. We're not going silent. The taxes are not going to increase that much. But it will give them 1 or 2 years, maybe we will catch up.
Follow up, Mr. Chair. I know you talked about how Oregon dealt with unemployment benefits in the last recession, and I do remember pretty clearly because I think maybe more than one of us was on the Labor Committee at the time, where we listened to people who worked at places like Intel, where both partners of a family would have been laid off from their job and losing their homes. And when we passed those extended unemployment benefits during that time, did the funding for that come out of the balance of the trust fund? And how would that work if we were in need of doing something like that in a future situation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's a great question. During 2005, we did have an extension. We had some extensions in 2003. We had, during that recession, I believe, 4 benefit extensions. One was paid solely by the federal government. It didn't impact our state trust fund at all. One was shared 50-50 with the state trust fund and the federal trust fund. And then there were 2 others that were paid right out of our trust fund. And one of the things that, if my recollection is correct, we set ceilings on those bills so we wouldn't help drive employer taxes up. So we infused more income in the economy, but did our best to keep from going to another tax rate schedule. So we're, with Ahmad's help, we're very mindful of what we call the gap between a certain schedule where we're at. So when we do approve benefit extensions, we work real closely with the legislature to make sure we don't increase employer taxes in those periods. Hopefully that answers your question.
So does that mean that we were able to pay those extended benefits, the state part of them, out of monies in the trust fund? That's how we were able to do it without raising rates? Or?
Mr. Chair, Representative Rosenbaum, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you very much. Other questions?
I have one, and maybe a follow-up. This approach to this trust fund appears to me to make eminently good sense. You're allowed to adjust the amount of taxes you collect based on the size of the fund and the expected payouts that you have in the future, along with the economy as it exists. How did that approach get set up in Oregon? Is this part of a general scheme that all the states in the country use, or is this something we came up with ourselves? How did this happen? This seems like an eminently wonderful plan on the part of the legislature, and I wonder who gets to take credit for it.
Mr. Chair, that's an excellent question. I'd like to lay that credit at the feet of our labor committees of the Oregon Legislature. Actually, this model was designed originally in 1975 in its current form, and it's based loosely on what the federal government will allow us to do. I will tell you, though, the U.S. Department of Labor sends states to Oregon to say, well, how are you guys doing it? Because many states in the last recession did go bankrupt, some very large states, and while they boast low employer tax rates, they had to come along with a huge, huge, huge surtax to bring their trust funds back to solvency, where we did not have to. So it was designed in 1975, and I believe we've had two bills over the past 30 plus years to lower the tax rates and smooth them out. And that, again, the credit goes to the legislature working real closely with our staff.
Mr. Chairman, member of the committee, I'd like to give a little comment on that. Answer your question. In the program, when it started in 1935, they did a lot of federal government did a massive amount of research on every aspect of that. And we have an experience rating. Each tax schedule has a number of brackets, and the one they use more benefit, they're going to pay high taxes. They wanted to set it that way, that encourage employers don't lay off people. You know, this is one aspect of that. And U.S. is the only country in the world has it. Europe doesn't have experience rating on any other country. U.S. has not. And all this, the system how to work and solvency and this kind of thing, it came from recommendation from federal government. A lot of state has a version of this. But as Tom mentioned, California, New York, and North Carolina got broke in the last recession. And the reason is that I was in a meeting in Washington, D.C. I was arguing. I said, you see, the benefit is indexed to inflation. The taxes they collect is not indexed. They're going to get broke when next recession comes. I guarantee you, if they haven't fixed it, they're going to get broke again, because they have to go, federal government forced them to go borrow money. They have to pay immediately, start increasing their taxes to pay it off, and if they don't pay it off, they increase their future tax or their IRS collected for them. So they're completely trapped. And Oregon is not like that. Oregon, when economy is good, we collect it, and economy is bad, we go to recession. We don't increase the taxes because smoothly go up and balance each other. I think it's one of the good system in Oregon really is working very good. And we monitor it. Sometimes we find out it's too high. We can, you know, adjust it like we did in 2005.
Thank you very much. I note that this system deals with issues that we are still struggling with in other parts of our tax system. So we'll have to commend the people back then. The question I had is that, do you anticipate coming in for any changes in the statute in 2009? And if so, what sort of areas would those likely be in?
We don't anticipate at this point any measures that would deal with the tax rate schedules.
Thank you. If it ain't broke, don't fix it. Thank you. Anything else? Thank you very much.
Thank you for your interest.
Thank you. Next up is Department of Consumer and Business Services.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Greg Malkasian. I'm the Deputy Director of the Department of Consumer Business Services. And today with me is Gary Helmer, our Senior Economist, if there are any particular detailed questions. The selected other funds revenue report highlights two major sources of other funds revenue for the Department of Consumer Business Services. One of them is labeled the workers' compensation insurance taxes, and that provides the funding for the administrative activities of the department, specifically the workers' compensation system. And the other is labeled the other employer-employee taxes, and that those monies provide benefits to injured workers and to beneficiaries of workers who died or were permanently injured in workplace accidents or illnesses. Specifically now, the other funds, employer-employee taxes, are collected through the cents per hour assessment that is determined by the department, and it is paid equally by employers and employees. The payments are made quarterly by the employers. The current assessment rate is 2.8 cents per hour and is projected to generate $151.6 million for the 07-09 biennium. As I indicated, these predominantly pay for benefits that are accrued to injured workers and their beneficiaries or their beneficiaries. The major area is called the Retroactive Assistance Program, and it's the largest program in the WBF. It amounts to, our estimate is $114.8 million or 76% of the $151 million forecast for the 07-09 biennium. And so injured workers who incur a permanent total disability, or beneficiaries of workers that died from a fatal accident or illness received in a workplace situation, are paid benefits by their insurer. But as the inflation goes up, specifically the average weekly wage, as that increases, that incremental difference is actually paid out of the worker benefit fund. The other elements are focused on efficiencies in the system to lower overall costs through early return to work programs that have been proven to be very effective, and that's the second largest program. There are other areas that are paid out of this fund as well. The reopen claims program, if there's a reopen claim after 5 years after date of injury, the benefits associated with that reopen claim would be paid out of this program. Workers who have multiple jobs, the benefits that would accrue from the job that wasn't related to that injury would be paid out of this program. And the non-compliant employer costs, that is paid initially out of this program. That difference between what we collect from the non-compliant employer, and this is an employer who did not have workers' compensation insurance coverage, and yet they had an injured worker, that difference between the collections and the actual costs are paid out of the premium assessment operating account, and that's the other fund that I'll be talking about today. There are a couple other fairly minor programs that are paid out of the worker benefit program. At the end of fiscal year 2007, the fund was at $168.7 million, which is a four-quarter fund balance. The long-term estimated liability for the fund is $941 million. Because these benefits are paid over a long period of time, we can manage with this lesser fund balance. The current balance represents 17.9% of that long-term liability. The methodology that we use for forecasting the other funds revenue in the for these worker benefit fund is based upon the estimated annual hours worked by employee in Oregon, and then the forecasted number of employees. The product of that is then multiplied by the worker benefit fund assessment rate, which is determined by the director each year, and that derives the total assessment revenue. The average annual hours worked estimate are derived from an occupational injury and illness survey that's administered by the Department of Consumer Business Services, and the forecasts for Oregon employment are based on the latest versions that are available from the Office of Economic Analysis. Each year, the forecast from the previous year is compared to the actual revenue. The average deviation over the past 8 years has been a tenth of a percent. We will be updating our forecast for the budget period and then also using the latest OEA data that's available. As Representative Rosenbaum had brought up earlier, with the new data, we'll be adjusting our forecast for the upcoming budget. The small deviation in the most recent other funds report are attributed to the downward influence of the Oregon employment. But as you indicated, Mr. Chair, the ability to set the rate allows us to manage this very effectively. The other area that's in this report is also known as the workers' compensation insurance, is the premium assessment revenue. And that area is provides the funding for the operational programs of the workers' compensation system within the Department of Consumer and Business Services. So we're talking about the Workers' Compensation Division, or OSHA, the safety element, the Workers' Compensation Board, the adjudicatory element, the Ombudsman for Injured Workers, and the Small Business Ombudsman. Insurers pay the premium assessment to the Department of Consumer and Business Services based on the amount of the insurance premium they earn. And then each quarter they pass that on to the department, and the insurers actually pay for that. In the case of self-insured employers, there's a simulated premium developed, which is basically what they would have paid to a private insurer, and they're assessed that as the premium assessment. The forecast for the workers' compensation premium assessment is based on the forecast of the workers' compensation earned premium. So it would be earned by the insurers. And it's forecast using a system based on many inputs available to the Department of Consumer and Business Services as well as the Office of Economic Analysis. The major inputs in this analysis is the workers' compensation claims, obviously a key factor, the incurred losses, the actual losses paid out for those claims, the insurer expense loading factor, which obviously is a portion of the premium that's paid by insureds, and then changes in approved premium rates. So the inputs are primarily driven by forecasts of employment, payroll, interest rates, and medical price indices that are provided through the Office of Economic Analysis. Each year, the forecast is compared to the actual premium, and then the average deviation over the past years has amounted to 3%. Now, that's the calculation of the premium, but this fund relates to the premium assessment, and so there's another step to that. The deviations of the calculation of the assessed premium assessment is based upon the premium rate, which is set through a rulemaking process, and then it's evaluated against the past 8 years, and that rate has changed 4.4% over those years. Now, the deviation in this particular other funds, it resulted from higher than forecast assessable premium in the calendar year 2006, and it resulted in an upward shift of future year calculations because of that unanticipated increase. And then the department also received a large settlement for unpaid premium taxes from an insurer of $3.4 million, and that impacted the actual expected onward revenue for both 2006 and 2007. The 2011-2013, which is pretty far out there, rates that you'll see there is a deviation, is based upon the result of projected increases in the workers' compensation rate for the calendar year 2011, whereas the prior forecast didn't anticipate a rate. But as I indicated earlier, we try to maintain a fund balance of two quarters in the premium assessment operating account, and we are currently a little bit over that, and so our rate is a little bit lower than what would be called an equilibrium rate, and so we find a need to increase it in those years. So that's the difference for that particular deviation. So that concludes our explanation of that. If there are any questions, I'd be happy to respond to them.
Thank you. Questions for this panel? Yes, sir, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Greg, how many years now have the pure premium rate either declined or stayed steady in the state?
This is actually a second consecutive. Oh, I'm sorry, Mr. Chair, Representative Witt. This is a second consecutive year that the rate has decreased, following 4 years in a row there were no changes to the rate. But prior to that, there were 12 consecutive annual decreases from 1991 to 2002.
Which, and so this is the better part now of two decades that we've had a significant declining path in pure premium rates.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, we've been very fortunate benefiting many employers and workers from the safety perspective.
What is the, over that period of time, what has been the percentage decline?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, since 1990, it's been 59.2% decline or $14.5 billion.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, sir.
And over that same period of time, has there been a 59% increase in our worker benefits under workers' compensation?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, there has been an increase. I'm not sure to the specific amount. I can get that information for you.
Thank you.
But there has been a significant increase in worker benefits.
Thank you. Other questions? Gentlemen, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Beck?
Thanks. Next up is Oregon University System.
Yes, sir.
Chair Barnhart, members of the committee, for the record, I'm George Pernstein from the Oregon University System. I'm joined today by Glenn Nelson, who is our director of all things budget for the university system. We're here to talk with you a little bit about our limited other funds, the most important of which, the largest of which, really is instruction and other fees paid by students. The instruction and other fees, you can see that that has actually trended up since the revenue forecast you saw in May. The first trend up between May and December is due to the fact that the budget that was approved by this legislature at the end of June anticipated some different things than had been anticipated in May. For example, revenue growth
was accepted by this legislature in the last session, and that then shows up in the forecast that we have. The second thing is that at the end of June, the legislature approved the shared responsibility model, and in doing so, making the appropriation and the opportunity grant, had discussions with us about what our tuition policy would be for the upcoming biennium, which meant that instead of what had been the case in the past, we have a 3.4% increase anticipated for most of the campuses for resident undergraduate students, which is tied to the estimated rate of growth in Oregon family income. Western Oregon University, as you will recall, was exempted from that because they were putting in a tuition promise where they froze their tuition for incoming freshmen for 4 years. So they had a somewhat bigger increase in order to carry them over the 4 years. But those decisions were made then toward the end of June, in consultation between the Board of Higher Education and various parts of the legislature, and we then updated the forecast in December to recognize the enrollment growth and the tuition changes that had been anticipated. The increase that you see now, a slight increase from the December forecast, is actually due to the fall 2007 actual revenue. We have additional revenue from non-resident students, primarily under the Western Undergraduate Exchange Program, above what we had expected. It's not a lot, but it's some. I think the more important thing to note is to look to the next year, not what the number is, but what it could be a year from now. As I may have said to some of you before, we've had more interest because of the shared responsibility model, because of the reinvestment that this body made in higher education. We've had more interest from incoming freshmen for next year than we've seen ever. And so I do not know whether they will enroll. I do not know whether they will pay tuition. But I do know that all of the signs are positive right now, and that we may in fact see additional tuition income in the second year of the biennium. I think that's what we were all hoping for, particularly when the shared responsibility model was passed. We don't yet know if it'll happen, but I would be very pleased to be here a year from now giving you that kind of an update, but I don't know if I will be.
Thank you. Are you finished with your presentation? Yeah, questions, please, for this panel. I think you're right that we were looking for a change that resulted from the shared responsibility model. A question that comes from that, do you think you have the capacity to accommodate the increased number of freshmen that you anticipate coming? At this point,
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, part of the discussion that we had with the Ways and Means Committee last time resulted in funding a part of an estimated enrollment growth package. That's the first time that it happened in 10 years. So that provides us with some of the resources that we would need, and we'll just wait to see what happens to see whether or not it's sufficient, and also obviously what happens with revenue forecast generally.
Okay. Do you have any indications of what effect the enrollment, tuition promise at Western might have on 4-year completions?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, we don't yet know the completion rate. I can tell you that two things happened at Western this fall that are notable. They had the biggest growth in overall enrollment in percentage terms among the system, and they had a major, major increase in retention from freshmen to sophomores. I'm not going to attribute anything to anything right now because it's too soon to know, but the indicators at Western were very, very positive this fall.
Thank you. I'm thinking about the presentation that was made a couple of days ago, and I think it was in the Workforce Committee. Yeah, I lose track of where I see these things, and in which the issue was how do you incent students to actually finish? And it occurred to me as you were talking about Western that was one of the ways of doing it, would be to say if you come now and you finish in 4 years, you will pay a flat tuition rate the whole time. If you drop out, then you're going to have to take what you get if and when you come back. And it sounds as though, from what you're saying, the early indications are that that's actually happening.
Mr. Chair, it does appear to be. All the indicators are up at Western.
Thank you. Other questions, sir, for the Chancellor?
Thank you, sir. We appreciate you waiting around for the whole meeting to make that short presentation. Mr. Beck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next up is Department of Fish and Wildlife.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Todd Lieberman. I'm the Administrative Services Division Administrator for the Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. To my left, I have Christine Broniak, the agency economist, and she will be making our presentation.
Wonderful. Please, go ahead.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. I'm here today to talk a little bit about our other funds revenue projections. For the record, my name is Christine Broniak, and I'm the staff economist. So to give you an idea about our total budget picture, our revenues expected for 2007-2009 include about $245 million in total. Of this, 46% is made up of other funds. Federal funds make up 42%, and smaller categories include general funds and lottery funds at 16% and 12%, respectively. Now, of this portion of other funds, 66% comes from the sale of hunter and angler licenses and tags, as well as some other miscellaneous revenues, such as sales of occupational licenses and parking at Sabi Island. Aside from the 66% of these other funds, that is from hunter and angler revenues, the most significant category aside from that is federal indirect revenues. Other funds is also made up of some of our smaller revenue categories, such as fines and forfeitures, rents and royalties, as well as Department of Revenue checkoff, non-game wildlife checkoff revenues that come in. So the part that I work on projecting is the hunter and angler revenues. There are some very key influences on these revenues. The first would be resource conditions. The populations of fish and wildlife in the state are very influential in determining who chooses to hunt and fish. The probability of success will be a large factor in whether somebody makes that choice to spend their weekend or time that way. In response to these resource conditions, the agency does set certain angling and hunting regulations. These might be in response to problems in the population or declining populations. We might have to send closures at a particular time, and these can also negatively influence our sales of licensed revenues. There is an underlying pattern of changing taste and preferences in the public that does happen to affect our revenues. There's an increasing degree of competing recreational opportunities. There's more to do, and it seems like less time to do it. Our recent survey on angling preferences indicated that the number one factor that influenced people's decisions not to hunt or fish were the lack of time. And so this is one of our biggest challenges. Furthermore, our licensed population, the people who purchase it are continually getting older, and as they do age, their participation in the sport will start to drop off. Furthermore, the final influence on hunter and angler revenues will be our fee levels. At this point, we are still in the zone where fee increases will get us significantly more revenues. There's a little bit of dropout in response to fee increases, but it is largely outweighed by increased revenues at this point. So here you can see our history of annual license revenues from hunter and angler licenses. As you can see, periods of fee increase really can drive increases in these revenues. In 1998, we had a fee increase. You see a little step there. up in 2000. There was another one. And we had a fairly substantial fee increase in 2004 that brought this revenue increase. We also added a shellfish license that did gain a lot of revenue from that. If we adjust these for inflation, you can see that in the 2007 adjusted dollars, we have a fee increase, and then over time, the inflation will start to eat away at that increase. And in real terms, it will decline. And we have another fee increase to keep up with inflation. You might notice here that the trend of the revenues has been going up slightly over the past years. And the reason for that would be we have increased cost of management. Some of our populations have been fairly labor-intensive to manage, as well as our personal services costs have been increasing with the healthcare increases, as I'm sure you're all aware. So now onto the projections. Quarterly, we send these projections to the Office of Economic Analysis. For the 2005-07 biennium, the revenues were higher than expected by about 2%. They came in at $80 million, whereas the projection was $79 million. This is due largely to strong sales in the first half of 2007, both of controlled hunt applications as well as fishing licenses. In the scheme of things, this revenue is a little bit of an anomaly, and we're not quite ready to stake our operations on that. So our future forecasts are a little bit tempered by the more conservative. We've had recent problems with some federal listing of coho on the coast, and some of the Columbia runs of salmon have not been doing quite as well. It remains to be seen how the wildlife populations on both the east and west side are doing. Our population census will be done in spring, and at that time we'll have a better assessment of what the conditions look like. And in response, we can manage that. So these forecasts are developed using several factors. First, it would be the track history and the ongoing experience of revenues. We have a mathematical model that we look by which we analyze the trends and the variability of each type of license, and it ultimately comes out with our forecast. The fee increase adjustments are modeled using the inferences from past fee increases. We have an econometric model that looks at previous reactions to fee increases, and from that we'll estimate the dropout rate. So as a result of that, we can come up with an estimate of what a fee increase will gain for us. If we do get a fee increase in the coming biennia, those projections that you see would increase probably substantially. So there are some difficulties in forecasting hunter and angler revenues. License and tag sales are highly seasonal. Oftentimes, people make choices to purchase their licenses at different times in the year. Of course, the summer would be the peak for fishing licenses, spring and summer. And because of our controlled hunt system, we do see a lot of tag sales that happen to coincide with those seasons. And we have applications for controlled hunts that are due in May. So there's a large influx of revenue at that time. Resource conditions can be quite variable. Oftentimes, we don't have the counts until spring, you know, to know what will happen with the next fall's hunting season. And finally, the underlying taste and preference variables are used to predict hunter and angler behavior, and this can be difficult. The most recent years, we've seen a little bit of an increase in hunter and anglers in the state and people who choose to buy these licenses, but overall the decline has been on the order of about less than 1% a year. And this is a nationwide problem. The western states all are showing some decline in the numbers of hunter and anglers. And the reasons for this are kind of difficult to quantify, but that's one of the challenges in forecasting. So this concludes my presentation. I would be happy to entertain any questions at this time.
Thank you. Questions? Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Ms., is it Brundage?
Bruniak.
Bruniak, excuse me. I'm sorry. Thank you very much for your presentation. I'm just curious how our license fees and tags and license fees compare with some of the other Western states. Are we a comparatively good buy, or?
Yes, I've done some of these analyses. Of course, there's a lot of complexity to different licenses and tag types. But overall, I'd say, you know, within the neighboring states, we have one of the best deals, if not the best deal, on hunting and fishing licenses. There might be some. I think Idaho might be more less expensive in some cases, but we are doing pretty well if you look at our neighbors in the area that we're in. But if you'd like, I could provide more information about that.
Thank you. I was just interested in a general overall comparison, Mr. Chairman, if I
may
continue. And I'm looking at your revenue in constant dollars here, and I'm wondering if that were overlaid with a number of folks who actually purchase licensing tags, whether the year 2004 would show as the fees increased, it looks substantially here, whether there was any drop off in the number of purchases as a result.
2004 did not see a drop off in the number of purchases. We had a good year with salmon returns, and we had a strong fishing season and a relatively strong hunting season. So the random effects came in, and they outweighed what our fee increase would have brought us, what the drop off would have been with our fee increase.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I know this wasn't really part of your report, but we did make some changes to the checkoff provisions on the tax form in this committee during the session. I can't remember exactly how those were structured, but it seemed like they were, I don't think they were a phase out, but there was some rotation or something that's going to happen where the checkoff, I thought for a while by frustration, takes a slightly different status. So do you have any comments about, given that the original proposal, I think, eliminated the checkoff and that got modified, do you have any comments about how this current implementation is going to work? Do you know what I'm talking about?
Yes. Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosebaum, we are, as we prepare our 09-11 budget, we will be taking one of the, that's one of the issues that we'll be looking at is we've, based on the folks that who were on the checkoff versus who's not on the checkoff, we will be looking at other revenue sources to put to bring us back up to par to where we can continue our diversity programs. But we are addressing that issue in the upcoming budget.
So follow up, Mr. Chair, it sounds like then you're anticipating a need for finding some other funding source at least to supplement what comes in through the checkoff.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Rosebaum, you are correct.
Thanks.
Thank you. Yes, Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. While it's not particularly apropos to your presentation here today, I would like to take this opportunity to thank the department for finding the means by which you could provide a spring Chinook salmon season on the lower Columbia River. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome.
We appreciate your presentation. Mr. Beck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Next up is the Department of Human Services.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Barely.
Representative Jerry Barnhart and members of the committee, for the record, John Swanson. I'm the administrator with the Budget and Planning Unit of the Department of Human Services. And I'll keep my comments fairly brief because this portion of the overall report is fairly small. This other fund revenue source for the department is comprised of a variety. It's called, patient care revenues. I should mention that first. Is comprised of a variety of reimbursement and recovery of patient care costs for medical, physical, and mental, and long-term care programs. So I don't know, the title talks about mental health and developmental disabilities. It actually includes all sorts of programs and services that are provided that recover actions are initiated afterwards. The reimbursement and recovery activities performed by the Office of Payment Accuracy and Recovery within the department, and they're primarily the agents that provide information on their estimates for recoveries, and based on that and trends, we put together this forecast that's a part of our budget. It's a relatively small portion of the overall budget for these mandated programs. The major issue here is in the report deals with estate recoveries. The overall patient care revenues are down, primarily related to discontinuation of the general assistance program, which was a general fund program which used to provide cash grants to very low income, severely disabled adults that had applied for and expected to receive Social Security benefits. And the program was phased out in the fall of 2005, and so there's not, this basically the first tier of recovery from the states that occur, and since that's no longer being paid to clients, the amount to recover is less than what it has been in the past. This revenue source is one of many that we track and factor in as we do our rebalance twice a year, roughly, and is considered in conjunction with caseload changes, cost per case changes, other sources of revenue, including federal participation, to see if we have a net issue that we need to bring forward. So that's really about it.
Thank you. Questions?
I have one. What percentage of the general assistance program costs do you actually end up recovering through these recoveries? And I assume we're talking primarily about repayment from the lump sum payment for Social Security.
Yes, that's correct. Chair Barnhart, I'm not sure of the actual amounts. I'll have to get that for you because it occurs over a long period of time to recover from these estates. We'll be doing it for some time out, and I'm not sure of what that ultimate percentage will
Thank
be.
You. That would be very helpful information to have. I know I have a number of constituents who are very interested in getting this general assistance program restarted.
Yes.
And that would be an ammo I could use either for or against it in the Ways and Means Committee.
I would be glad to provide.
Thank you. Thank you. That's very helpful. Thank you very much. Mr. Beck?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The last up is Department of Parks and Recreation. By the way, with your permission, next time we present to you this selected other funds forecast, we could reverse the order.
that may, in fact, be a good idea. And, in fact, I'm thinking seriously about making sure that we allocate more time. I think that it would be useful for us to go into some more depth in some of these areas. And with the format we have today, it simply isn't possible. As you can see, the committee is slowly dribbling away. And our session will begin in 11 minutes. So we only have a few minutes for this presentation. And I apologize for that in advance.
That's okay.
Please go ahead.
Good morning, Chair Barnhart and Representative Witt, who gladly stayed here and stuck this out with us, saving the best for last. I am Lisa Van Landen, the Assistant Director for Administrative Services at Oregon Parks and Recreation Department. And today I'll try to share with you a very brief overview of our methodology in which we use to forecast our department's other fund revenue. Did you get this on Friday, the handout? Because if not, I have a copy.
You did.
Yes. You do have it? Okay. Do you need one?
No, I need my homework.
Jim will handle it. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
initial see in the handout that we're providing are the fund revenues generated. This particular presentation is on our park user fees, which consists of overnight camping, day use fees, reservations, and the Wolf Creek Inn. And so I'll just give you a brief overview of each of those areas. We have 57 camping parks statewide, and 28 of those parks are open year-round. And based on our monthly tracking of visitation, overnight camping has remained flat in the recent years. And many existing parks are at or near capacity during our prime season, which is May through September. Certain campsites, such as yurts and cabins, have very high occupancy rates, as you can imagine. Overnight camping can fluctuate with weather conditions, especially on long holiday weekends during our prime season. The December storms actually contributed to a lot of cancellations for us during. I'm surprised at how many folks actually head up for the holidays in our cabins and yurts. Visitation is possibly impacted by fuel prices and economic conditions, and temporary or long-term construction closures can impact our anticipated revenue. Even more unusual, a catfish die-off in the Snake River that created another decrease for us. Can't forecast well for that. Projections of increased revenue are primarily attributed to the opening of new parks such as Stud Stewart or adding additional camping facilities in our parks. The first table on page one, the first illustration there, and provides you with a description of how revenue estimates for a new park are formulated. And this one's Stub Stewart. The calculation's based on the number of sites types, and then the number of days by season, projected occupancy rates, and then that will determine our daily rental rates to get it to our estimates for revenue. One additional note on page two there, that other table summary. That actually demonstrates the destination parks and the value parks. It just kind of shows you the difference in prices there. Mm-hmm. So you can see that destination parks generally have a higher visitation because they're generally located to a natural resource or a historical attraction, where the actual value parks may not have the showers and amenities that the destination parks offer. Days fees is another thing that we want to talk about, and those are charged in 26 of our parks. It's a $3 day use fee, a $25 annual pass, and a $40 per 2 year pass. And there are additional charges to the rental of picnic areas. Day use is very dependent on the weather, and inclement weather will discourage folks from heading out for a day use to one of our parks. We do track monthly trends in visitation as well as revenue. And our agency processes camping reservations at our call center, which is Reservations Northwest, which is located in Portland. There's a $6 fee for charging for those reservations, and there's also a $6 cancellation or modification fee to any existing reservation. There's been a significant change where we're seeing web increase fees are increasing for folks doing their internet web and internet reservations versus phone-in reservations. So overall, we're anticipating a slight increase in reservation revenue, but that doesn't mean there's going to be a slight increase in camping. That just means folks are tending to go out and do it on the internet rather than trying to make those phone calls. So there'll be or show up at the park and not have a site available. The other thing we want to talk about is the historic Wolf Creek Inn. It was built in 1883, and it's 20 miles north of Grants Pass. It consists of a restaurant and a 9-room hotel, and its revenue has been fairly steady at $650,000 per biennium, and it can fluctuate with gas prices, and we're told by the manager there, with the exchange rate, as many of our guests are European guests.
Well, that's like an increase now with the euro.
Yeah, exactly. Value being higher. Yeah. The forecast for 507 actuals were about $1 million, nearly 3% less than projected. However, notably, $805,000 of that was an unanticipated transfer for the state fair, which we inherited in January of 06. And so adjusting for this, our actuals were less than about 0.7% of our forecast. And one last item I'd like to mention, our commission is proposing the analysis of the impact of what a rate increase would look like on our revenues. And with that, knowing that you want to head out of here, I'll answer any questions you might have.
Who controls your fee increase?
We have not had a fee increase since 1996, but it's in statute.
It would be up to the legislature.
It would be up to the legislature.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm sure that Stub Stewart, who I knew very well, would be pleased to know that you're handling his park also very well.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Senator,
Representative Wick, do you have any questions?
No questions. Mr. Chairman, just a comment that I think if you take a look at some of the fees that are charged and whatnot here and the opportunities that this presents, that this is a tremendous opportunity for the public to be able to enjoy the outdoors and to recreate, and that I think our parks just do a tremendous job in their management. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Barnhart and Representative Witt. We appreciate that. Thank you.
Thank you very much, and thank you very much for waiting all the way through this long meeting. We appreciate it.
No problem. Thank you.
Mr. Beck, do you have anything to close?
No, sir.
Thank you very much. Well, with that, we've completed our business for today, just in the nick of time, and the committee is adjourned.